Welcome to this Rector Seminar. As many of you know, I'm the Rector of Exeter, Rick Trainer, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this talk, which Professor Verlin Flieger is going to give a lecture to celebrate the publication of The Story of Kullervo by J.R.R. Tolkien. Kullervo, and I know I speak in the presence of many people who know far more about Tolkien than myself, but Kullervo, which was Tolkien's first sustained work of creative fiction, was written while he was an undergraduate at Exeter College, Oxford, in 1914 and 1915. So it's natural that we should be holding an event to celebrate the publication in this college. I think it's also natural that we should make available, as part of the evening, the opportunity to buy copies of the book. We're going to have a drinks reception after Professor Flieger's lecture and the question and answer session upstairs in the drawing room at the rector's lodgings. And Blackwell's, on behalf of the publishers, HarperCollins, who published the book in late August, will be making copies available. But it's especially appropriate, I think, that this talk be given by Professor Verlin Flieger, who is Professor Emerita of English at the University of Maryland, College Park. She holds a PhD from the Catholic University of America and is a renowned specialist in comparative mythology. Along with herself being a novelist, she's one of the longest standing and most distinguished of Tolkien scholars. Among many other works, including critical editions of works by Tolkien, she's the author of Splintered Light, Logos and Language in Tolkien's World, which he published in 1983 and a revised edition in 2002. A Question of Time, J.R.R. Tolkien's Road to Faerie, published in 2001. Interrupted Music, The Making of Tolkien's Mythology in 2005. And Green Suns in Faerie, Essays on J.R.R. Tolkien, which he published in 2012. And as if that weren't enough, she's also the co-author editor of Tolkien Studies, an annual journal covering scholarly analysis of Tolkien's work. And this evening, among other topics, she's going to consider how, now that Kullervo has been properly published, it alters our understanding of this famous author from the one that prevailed before its publication. So it's with great pleasure, it's an honor, for me to ask Professor Flieger to address us in this celebratory lecture. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you very much, Professor Rector. Organizer of this very nice gathering. Thank you all for coming out on such a lovely evening to listen to a lecture. It is a great, great honor for me to be here at Tolkien's old college. I know that it meant a great deal to him. He loved his time here, and he thought with great, great fondness of his years here after he left, and never forgot his beginnings, in a sense. So it's a great pleasure for me to bring together several beginnings, Tolkien at Exeter and Tolkien, the author at Exeter. And the first thing that I would like you to remember, which Rick has already reminded you of, is how young he was. This is not the pipe-smoking grandfather sitting under the tree that you're used to seeing from the book jackets. This is not even the 40-ish Oxford Don who wrote The Hobbit. This is a very, very young man, 22 years old, 1914, just at the beginning of his career, at the beginning of his creative powers, just feeling, at a in a sense, the impulses that are going to turn him into the author of the century some years from now. It is a book written by a very young man, and it has all the energy, all the liveliness, all the power that I think accrues to people who begin to write very early. So I'll start by giving you a synopsis. Strife between brothers ends with one brother murdering the other and appropriating his lands, his wife, and his son. The son is understandably very angry, very resentful, and begins to behave in a very peculiar and rather antic way, which so alarms the uncle that he sends him away to try to get rid of him. While he is away, the young man questions his own identity, questions the meaning of life, wonders why he is alive, and in the midst of all of this, manages to elude his hosts, who are also his captors, and to escape back to the home territory, where unfortunately he becomes involved with the suicide by drowning of a young woman with whom he has had an affair. He is so torn by grief and guilt that he contemplates suicide. He feels that the only thing left for him to do, the only one action he still can take, is that of revenge, of avenging his father's death, which he does, killing his uncle, laying waste to his homestead, and then feeling that there is really nothing left for him to do, he dies by his own sword. That, roughly, is the plot of the story of Kullervo. But you will also have noticed that it is the plot of a rather more familiar work by William Shakespeare, Hamlet. Tolkien called it a very great story, and it is clear, I think, from the way he wrote about it, that he knew that it was Hamlet. He knew that it was also something that partook of the medieval precursors of Hamlet, the Danish story of Amalthus and Gestae Danorum. There's an Icelandic version, the Ambales saga. There's even a Celtic version of Amleth or Amleth or Amlodi. So Tolkien knew that he'd got something very special on his hands, and it was something that he very much clearly wanted to have a go at. You can't accuse him of modesty. He was perfectly willing to follow in the footsteps of some very, very great precursors. So the story of Kullervo stands as an emblem of Tolkien's first real attempt at serious prose narrative. He'd written some poems. He'd made a start on what became his mythology. But he had never, as far as we know, undertaken a serious piece of prose fiction before this. In 1914, he wrote to his then fiancée, Edith, that he was trying to turn one of the stories from Kalevala, the Finnish mythology, into a short story, quote, along the lines of Morris, William Morris, with chunks of poetry in between. And if you read the story, you will see that it is very much in the style of William Morris. It's rather archaic. Much of the diction is, I will not say strained, but I will say self-conscious, artificial, and there are great long chunks of poetry in between, which most people skip over. It is also the story that taught him, I think, how to write. It taught him three important things that he used and drew on and made his own in all of his subsequent writing. It taught him how to make a world out of words. It taught him how to construct the arc of a story. It taught him how to use language to create an ambience. And it taught him how to construct a character. So that's a lot for a beginning writer to undertake. And what I'd like to do now is, in a sense, just unpack those things and tell you a little bit more about each one of them. I've got to check my notes here. First of all, how to make a world. I don't know how many of you have read Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, but in that essay, he talks about what he calls sub-creation. Sub because God is the creator, and human beings are under God, sub-creators or apprentice creators, but willing to make and able to make in the image of their maker. And what they make is a world, what he called a secondary world, a world based on this world, the real world, but one that is entirely a rather fantastic construct. He was here at Exeter and in training for the military when he made this discovery. And here's what he said. It was just as the 1914 war burst on me that I made the discovery that legends depend on the language alone, but a living language depends equally on the legends which it conveys by tradition. Well, what does that mean, really? Again, if we unpack it, it means a pretty major discovery, and that is that legend and language and the imagination are all parts of the same thing. The fact that it was something, a realization that burst on him at the time of the war, I think is something we need to pay attention to as well, because the war sharpened his faculties and increased his acuity and made him extra aware of all the relationships in the education that he was getting at the time. Just before he came up to Exeter, when he was still at King Edward School in Birmingham, he had discovered the Finnish Kalevala, which is the great Finnish mythology, the land of heroes, that was so important a gift to the Finns that it had a major part in their push for independence, which they finally got during the war in 1917. Kalevala was a late comer to the world's mythologies, many of which Tolkien knew. He knew the Celtic, the Norse and Germanic, he knew the Greek. But Kalevala was not published until in the first version, 1835, the old Kalevala, and in a complete or a more complete version, 1849, what's called the Kalevala. Tolkien read it in 1911, and he was simply bowled over. It hit him with as much power as it hit the Finns. Let me read you what he says about it. He says in the essay that he wrote to accompany the story of Kullervo. This about its effect on him. You discover the Kalevala, the land of heroes, and you are at once in a new world and can revel in an amazing new excitement. You feel like Columbus on a new continent, or Thorfinn in Vinland the Good. When you first step onto the new land, you can, if you like, immediately begin comparing it with the one you've come from. Mountains, rivers, grass, and so on are probably common features to both. Some plants and animals may seem familiar, especially the wild and ferocious human species. But it is more likely to be the almost indefinable sense of newness and strangeness that will either perturb you or delight you. Trees will group differently on the horizon. The birds will make unfamiliar music. The inhabitants will talk a wild and at first unintelligible lingo. At the worst, I hope, however, that after this, the country and its manners may have become more familiar, and you have got on speaking terms with the natives, and then you will find it rather jolly to live with this strange people and these new gods, with this race of unhypocritical, scandalous heroes. And at the last, you may feel you do not want to go back home for a long while, if at all. I think it's safe to say that there is a sense in which Tolkien never did go back home. If you listen to what he's saying here, it's not as if he's talking about a piece of literature. He's talking about a world. He's talking about a world that is so new and so strange to him that he feels like Columbus in discovering it. And that first entry into Kalevala and the world of that myth is what gave Tolkien the idea of subcreation, of the secondary world. Here is where it started, in 1911, and it flowered, as many of you I hope know, in his own Middle Earth. But there's a direct line between the two. So that's one way in which the story of Kullervo and Kalevala are important to Tolkien. And another is the connection between the world and the language. It was just as the 1914 war burst on me that I made the discovery that legends depend on the language to which they belong. Fair enough. But the language depends on the legends. That's taking things to another level. And again, what does that mean? It meant for Tolkien that you cannot have a language without people who speak it. Language does not occur in a vacuum. And if you have people to speak it, they've got to live in a world which they will describe in terms of that language. So the world itself, in a sense, generates the language that is spoken in it. And that language will inevitably be the history and the story of that world. So you've got language, world, mythology, creating its own version of the language, feeding back into the world, feeding the mythology, and a circle that goes round and round and in a sense never stops. He says to ask what is the origin of stories is to ask what is the origin of language and of the mind. They're all the same age, and they all feed on one another. That, again, is something he learned from here. And it was with his own version of the story of Kullervo that he first had a hand at making a world, at trying quite consciously to be a sub-creator. This is where he began very, very tentatively the invention of what would, as they matured, I said eventually, become his Elvish languages. And you can see it happening. the first page of the manuscript, which I have had the great privilege to look at, is taken almost verbatim, translated into prose, from the Kalevala, that is its source. And it starts out with a swan having three cygnets who are going to be the three major characters. And he uses the Finnish words. He talks about Suomi, which is Finnish for Finnish. He talks about Karelia. He talks about Russia. And in the first paragraph, you see him make a little tick by those place names, and in the left-hand margin, write out his own invented name instead, so that Suomi becomes Sutse. It looks like Finnish, but it's not. It's Tolkien. Karelia becomes Telia, again, modeled on Finnish, but not in Kalevala. And Russia becomes Kemenume, the great land, the sort of looming power to the east that overwhelmed and almost swallowed up Finland in its own history. So on the first page of the story of Kullervo, Tolkien is already moving out of just adaptation into invention, into world making. And one of the lovely things about looking at the manuscript, and I was lucky enough to be able to get the first page reproduced, it's a pretty bad reproduction, but there it is, adjacent to the first page itself, so that you can see it happening on the page. You can see him taking command of his language, and you can see him using that language to create a world that is like Finland, and you can recognize the trees, but is not Finland, is his own invented world instead. That's one of the things that he learned. He made the trajectory of the story a pretty grim one, but within it, he was able to interpolate, as he said, chunks of poetry. And I don't know about you, but I usually skip the poetry when I read. And I did when I read The Lord of the Rings for the first time, except for the troll song. I skipped some of the fancier things. But if we look at this, the poetry really has nothing to do with the story, but everything to do with the world making. It's a very long, who was it said, poetry is a charming meander on down the middle of the page with meadows of margin on either side. That's what he's got. But he uses a number of made-up names, names such as Palliki, Telenda, Koltuze, Pulu, Kuru, Ilu, Ilwinti, Manoini, Malolo. Do any of these start to sound familiar? If you've read the Silmarillion, yes. Tanto, Lempo, Samyan, Sampia, Amontu, Terenyi, Asimo, Lumia. He's, in a sense, beginning to feel his power. I can do this. I can make my own words, and I can make them create the world that I want. So he interpolates into the story of Kullervo a long charm, it's called a cattle charm, that has nothing to do with the plot whatsoever. But it has a lot to do with his ability to make a world out of words and out of names. Send the daughter, it starts, guard my kine, my cattle, O gracious Ilu, from the perils in the pathway. Send the daughters of Ilwinti to guard my kine from danger. For many are thy maidens at thy bidding in Manoini, and skilled to herd the white kine. Come now, maidens, great and ancient, mighty daughters of the heaven. Come now, children of Malolo, at Iluko's mighty bidding. O Urlo, most wise one, do thou guard my flock from evil. O thou Sampia, most lovely, blow the honey horn most gaily. Palaki's little damsel, and Telinda, thy companion. And you're thinking, why are you wasting time on all of this, when as soon as this charm is over, Kullervo is going to murder the woman who is speaking it, and we'll get on with the action. But what he's doing is setting up a kind of animistic world of nature spirits who will guard the cattle, who live in the woodland. And the idea of it comes right out of Kalevala, where there is a similar cattle charm, but not a much less interesting one, actually. Noble daughters of creation, Suvatar, the best of women, Etelatar, nature's old one, Hongatar, the noble mistress, Katayatar, maiden fairest, Pulayatar, little damsel, Tuometar, Tapio's daughter, Mialiki, Woodstep's daughter, Tellervo, the maid of Tapio. It's a clump of names. And what Tolkien has done is to take it and unpack it and scatter it throughout his cattle charm as a way of creating the world. All of these names have meaning. Suvatar means summer. Etelatar means south wind. Hongatar means fir tree. Katayatar means juniper. These are tree fairies. Pilayatar means ash, mountain ash or rowan. Tuometar, cherry tree. Mialiki, wood stepdaughter. They are all, in a sense, I guess you call them dryads. But they are also the precursors of Tolkien's pantheon of the Silmarillion of Middle-earth, of Ilúvatar, of Manwë, of Aule, of Ose, of Yavanna, of all of the gods and demigods of his created world. These are the ancestors of these, and these are the ancestors of Tolkien's own pantheon. So again, it's the story of Kullervo that got him started on it. Another thing that he learned was how to create character. And I don't know how many of you are fully aware of the relationship of the story of Kullervo to Tolkien's own mythology. Has anybody got that? Any nods? Okay. Yes. What is it?
The story of Turin.
The story of Turin to Rambar. Yes. There's a straight line from Tolkien's Kullervo to the story of Turin to Rambar, who was the great epic hero of his mythology, the great tragic hero, and I think one of the most interesting characters in his whole work, his whole epos. For many, many years, we had known that Turin to Rambar was influenced by Kalevala because Tolkien said so. He said Kalevala was the germ. Kalevala set the rocket off in story. Kalevala, he said, nearly ruined his Honor Mod's examinations because he was writing that when he should have been studying. And he very nearly got sent down. But what we didn't know was that there was a middle element, that there was a bridge between the Kalevala Kullervo and his own Turin to Rambar. And that bridge was his version of Kullervo, who is one of the most carefully drawn, I would say deeply drawn, characters in all of his work, for all that this is a young text and a young author. Poulervo is instantly recognizable, as is Turin. He is cranky, cantankerous, resentful, unfriendly, angry, hard to get to know, hard to like, just the kind of guy that you would recognize in a bar, but you wouldn't want to go up and have a beer with him. But he is a much more sharply drawn character than many of the early characters that Tolkien talks about and writes in his first real attempts at his own mythology in what's called the Book of Lost Tales, which he began after the war. So the distinction that he is able to give Kullervo, who is cranky, cantankerous, resentful, angry, got a chip on his shoulder, totally wrong-headed, comes from Tolkien's own experience of having worked with a character like that before. So he knows what he's talking about. He knows how to handle him. He adapts him to Turin from Kullervo by giving him all of Kullervo's characteristics and yet strangely making him very attractive so that people love him in spite of himself. But Turin is the great wrong-headed hero of Tolkien's Silmarillion mythology, responsible for some of its worst disasters, and yet responsible for them because of the kind of character that Tolkien has developed in him, which makes us sympathetic to him. Kullervo also influences, how can I put this? It's not a direct line, but you can see bits and pieces of Kullervo cropping up in what Tolkien writes ever after. You can see him, for example, in the character that Tolkien called Frodo, who was an orphan, who was adopted by an uncle and taken to live with him, who is sent away on a long journey, who is unable, finally, to complete the task that he has been set, and comes back to his home and to some pretty bitter realizations of how he has failed. I'm not saying Kullervo and Frodo are blood brothers, but that this kind of material which Tolkien was working with is something that we can see him reworking, altering, turning sometimes inside out in the major fiction that he wrote from there on. We've seen Turin Turambar, who was a direct descendant. Frodo, who was a kind of lateral descendant. But how about Gollum? How about the outsider, the loner, the angry, the resentful, the vengeful Gollum with a grudge against humanity, who is certain that the world hates him and he hates it back? That too owes something, I think, to Tolkien's early experiences with Kullervo. So we've got world, language, myth, the beginnings of an understanding of how to create character. And now I would like to come to what is really the most striking thing about the story of Kullervo, and the one that people least expect, and that is its profound darkness. It's a bleak story. There's not a ray of light, not a glimmer of hope, no chance for Kullervo ever possibly to have any kind of life of his own. And at first, you're going to think, well, this is rather odd. This is not typical Tolkien. This is not the man who wrote The Hobbit or Farmer Giles. This is not even the man who wrote the wonderful epic of The Lord of the Rings, which has songs and cheer and good food and jokes, and yes, it's got some battles, but on the whole, it is a sort of upbeat story. And I think Kullervo, if we read him carefully, will make us look again. Yes, The Hobbit is a children's story. Yes, it starts out in a kind of jokey fairy tale way with a pseudo wizard and a funny little guy, a hobbit with furry toes. And you start to think, well, this is kind of cute, but that's okay, it's for children, and children will like it. And he sends his hero, Bilbo, on a quest with some dwarves, and for the first part of it, it's kind of a spoof fairy tale. None of the dangers is particularly dangerous. You know perfectly well that they're all going to turn out all right. But if you look very, very carefully, there are clues, even at the beginning. When Bilbo invites all the dwarves, reluctantly, into his house and starts to give them tea, they enjoy the tea, and then they bring out their musical instruments and they begin to play. And as they play, the dark comes in the windows. Because the sun is going down. It's getting dark, but that's not what Tolkien describes. He talks about dark coming into the room with the music. And Bilbo gets very nervous and says, what about a little light? And the dwarves say, we like the dark. Dark for dark business. And their dark business is pretty dark, even in a spoof fairy tale. They are going on a dragon quest to get back their gold. It seems mythic, and we follow them along, thinking that it's kind of light, kind of not frivolous, but airy, until you get to the chapter with Gollum, which is totally down in the dark, which leaves Bilbo stranded in the dark, terrified and alone, and not knowing where he is. And the tone changes with the entrance of that character. Now, the narrator says, down here lived old Gollum. I don't know who he was or where he came from. And he's being perfectly honest. As a narrator, he doesn't know. But I want to suggest that I know where he came from. And I know who he is. And he is the lineal descendant of Kullervo, the dark, angry, vengeful spirit that Tolkien first began to write about. From then on, the story becomes much more serious. And when it gets... I don't know, how many of you have read The Hobbit? How many... Am I talking to people who know what I'm talking about? Yes, for the most part. Well, when the dwarves get to Lake Town, suddenly the tone changes again, because what enters the story? Politics. The dwarves and the wood elves and the men of Lake Town are all jostling for position and trying to figure out who has jurisdiction over what. And the master of Lake Town is out for anything he could get. And the story then devolves or evolves, you could take your choice, into a highly politicized story, strongly reminiscent of England and Europe in 1913 and 1914, in which people who ought to be friends with each other are pitted against each other in a fight over territory and gold and who it belongs to. That's not a children's story. That's a very adult and highly politicized story in which suddenly all of the high ideals of the fairy story genre become corrupted, including our hobbit hero, Bilbo, who is hired as a burglar, but of course doesn't think he is one, and the reader doesn't believe he is one, and then he steals the Arkenstone. Flat out takes it, knows he shouldn't, and slips it in his pocket. So he becomes corrupted. The dwarves become much, much more driven by greed, by acquisitiveness, by some pretty adult ambitions, and the whole children's story ends with a battle of five armies, which, if it doesn't recall to you the battles on the Eastern and the Western front in World War I, certainly recalled it to Tolkien. My point being that what we read on the surface as a jolly children's story has some very, very dark aspects to it, and I suggest that we wouldn't be so likely to tease them out if we didn't know about the story of Kullervo. The same thing is true, of course, only writ much larger, of The Lord of the Rings, which starts out as if it were going to be The Hobbit all over again. And then in a story, in a chapter called The Shadow of the Past, and there comes the dark again. The whole thing changes, turns on a dime, and becomes a story of terrible history. The ring and what it will do to people. And their quest then becomes, and you don't realize this until it's almost over, defeated before it begins in Frodo's attempt to throw away the ring. When he gets to Mount Doom, and this is not what's supposed to happen in a fairy story, he changes his mind. He fails. He says, I won't do this. The ring is mine. And suddenly you feel as if the rug is pulled out from under you. This nice little guy in this pleasant story has suddenly turned into someone that you don't know and he doesn't know. And Tolkien has had the laugh on you in a sense because he's told you all along that this is what is going to happen. He saves the day by having his other Kullervo figure, Gollum, do what he has to do, exact his own kind of revenge, try to take the ring, bite it off Frodo's hand with the finger, and topple himself into the fires, thus destroying himself and the problem. That, too, comes out of the story of Kullervo. So I would like to leave you with the idea that this unassuming and not very well-known story, which was Tolkien's first attempt, has in it all the seeds of his later work, has in it all of the elements that are going to flower, that are going to be developed from language, from knowing how to make a world and a pantheon, and knowing the connections between language and imagination and storytelling, to some of his major characters, to the trajectory of his greatest work, which, if you include The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings, is what, some several thousand pages? I would both leave you with that and start you off with that if I can, because I think I've said enough. I would like to hear what your questions are. Thank you for listening.